This week on Behind the Lens. Education News Roundup. New Orleans Public School District has almost completed a water filter installation project on school drinking fountains. The class action lawsuit against John F. Kennedy High School may be expanding. And an error by state education officials could result in a longer federal consent decree for New Orleans schools. Marta Jusen has the latest on those stories. Also, a recommendation this week that Entergy New Orleans should be, quote, net zero carbon emissions by the year 2050 to help combat the effects of global warming. Michael Isaac Stein has the details. I'm Jessica Rosegard. You're listening to Behind the Lens, a podcast by The Lens.
Brought to you by community support. Learn more at support.thelensnola.org.
There were a lot of developments this week on stories that Lens education reporter Marta Jusen has been following for months. I sat down with Marta to catch up on everything from water filters in schools to the Kennedy lawsuit and a federal consent decree on special education in the city. Marta, thanks for joining me. We've got a lot to cover. You've been reporting on a lot of different issues that are all very important as kids in the area go back to school. Let's start with water filters. The New Orleans Public School District was undergoing a project to install lead filtration systems in water fountains at schools. You've reported on that quite a bit. What's the status of that project?
So after 3 years, we're happy to report that they are at least 95% installed, that the filters on drinking fountains, that is. Well, I haven't checked in with them in the last week or so they might be all the way there, but I know they had a few specialty fits and unique situations where they didn't have filters on some drinking fountains yet.
So the next phase of this project is other water sources in schools like kitchens.
Right. So initially in 2016, when they promised they were going to test the water, they were talking about all water sources in the schools. They didn't get around until contracting for filters until 2017. And then because of bidding issues, they didn't actually start installing them until 2018. So when all those kind of bidding issues were taking place, I think they decided to drop the kitchen filter part and save that until they actually got the drinking fountains figured out. So now that they're basically done with the drinking fountains, they are moving on to the kitchens. They're going to put out a bid in the fall, so it'll be interesting to see what they're looking for. They can either purchase filters for every single kitchen faucet, or they can get a point of entry system, which would filter the water before it came into the building in the kitchen. So it'll be interesting to see what the breakdown on prices for that is.
Do you have any idea about how long this process might take between contract bidding and actual installation?
I don't, but based on the length of the last project, I am not willing to hold my breath.
That's totally fair. And just to be clear, the school district never tested for lead, so they're not actually certain that there is lead in the water in these schools.
Right. Just like the rest of the city, you know, the city says it puts out clean water and that it has a chemical in the water that protects against leaching of lead pipes. So they drink the same water that we drink at home. So yeah, you're right. The schools don't know if they have a problem, but there have been problems in the past in the city. You know, construction equipment can knock loose lead particles. And so they decided that filters were the safest way to go all around.
And this did come out because there has been a student that tested the water at their own school, right?
Right. That certainly propelled the installation of the filters this spring. The district had already planned to do it, but when that Plessy student got those kind of off the shelf test results back, that really kind of kicked the district into high gear.
So there was at least that one instance of a positive test result for lead in school water.
Right, but the school district was very clear that it was a positive test result from a, like, basically over-the-counter test, and that it wasn't, you know, necessarily a lab standard test. So, you know, we won't ever know for sure because now they've got filters in there.
Okay, let's move on to the latest developments in the John F. Kennedy graduation scandal. Suzette Bagnaris is the lawyer who brought a suit on behalf of a Kennedy student, and she's now seeking to expand that lawsuit to include the current student body of JFK High School. What is she saying?
Well, she thinks that the problems that seniors experienced and that led many of them, nearly half of them, not to be able to graduate on time are pervasive throughout the school. The state, when it did its investigation, noticed that some students had never received foundational courses and that the school didn't really appear to have a plan to provide kids with those courses. So Bagnaris is saying, you know what, this probably happened to all kids. So she's expanding it to the younger kids, the juniors, junior, sophomore, and freshmen. And, you know, it'll be really interesting to see what she finds in Discovery, if we get to that point.
Bagnaris also says that this crisis is extending to students who have tried to transfer out of Kennedy. Is that right?
That is what she told us. I haven't talked to any students who experienced that personally, but I mean, we know a lot of seniors had trouble getting their transcripts over the summer. So if the state was really, you know, cautiously looking over those transcripts for the seniors, I'm sure they would be too for the younger students.
And when students transfer, given that we're in a charter school system and there's not a set defined specific curriculum that every charter school shares, we had talked in the recently about that sort of issue of justifying coursework. And if you don't have a proper transcript, it's probably even harder to justify what coursework has been done from one school to the next.
Exactly. And I'm sure that any school that was potentially going to intake one of those students was concerned about what that transcript would look like and what they might have to make up for. Now, that would not be any reason that that school could deny a student, but it definitely raises concerns.
And you reported a few weeks ago that KIPP New Orleans would be taking over the charter for Kennedy at the end of the school year. Do you have any updates on how that transition is looking, how it might work, or if anything's been started yet?
I know KIPP was planning to get in there right away. They were working with Kennedy to help provide teachers if they were short anywhere. And then I think KIPP just really wants to be kind of hitting the ground running on this one because there's a lot to make up for with all these questionable courses and questionable transcripts.
Another issue you've been reporting on deals with a federal consent decree monitoring special education programs in New Orleans schools. This week, a lawyer with the Southern Poverty Law Center said mistakes have been made under the consent decree. What are they saying happened?
The consent decree is something that I always kind of have in the back of my mind while reporting on schools in New Orleans. I often find myself reporting on special education issues, and so that consent decree is something that I'm always thinking about. I got a tip that there were had potentially been issues in selecting the schools that were monitored under something called related services, which is like physical therapy or speech therapy or anything that you're getting if you're a special ed student who needs whose needs require extra services. That the schools they selected to monitor for that particular part, which is one of four parts of the consent decree, had been chosen improperly. And the State Department admits as much. They said in 2017 and 2018, in the fall of both of those years, they picked the wrong schools to monitor for related services when they should have picked the schools that had the lowest percentage of a certain rate that they calculate. They, in fact, picked the schools that had the highest percentage of that rate. So Neil Ranew with the Southern Poverty Law Center is very quick to point out that, you know, that's a pretty nice thing for them to have coming into a monitoring session, is to have picked the school with the highest ratio, and they're really setting themselves up for a good review there. And he thinks, you know, that's a really big problem, because if we are in a special ed compliance and monitoring situation, you want to be looking at your schools that are maybe not doing so well and finding out what the problems actually are.
So what might be the consequences of these potential mistakes or these alleged mistakes?
I think there are both immediate consequences, and then there's a kind of a bigger picture to look at. So the immediate consequences, like Neil pointed out, are that there are certain years that the state was not monitoring those schools when it should have been. And he says that's something that they can't make up for. Now the state says, oh, don't worry, once we figured it out, we went back and we added those schools to our monitoring. But the Southern Poverty Law Center says, you know, that's not enough. That's too little, too late. You, in fact, missed out on the potentially poorest quality schools in those crucial years. In the bigger picture, the state has been under this consent decree for a number of years. And to get out of the consent decree, you have to be found substantially compliant for 3 years in a row. So they already had that initial finding 2 years ago. They had a second finding of substantially compliant with everything they're being monitored for last year. And we have another annual review, our status report from the independent monitor, coming up likely this fall or late summer was usually when they're being released. So, you know, this is huge, right? If this calls into question whether or not the state is compliant, you know, with what the court has ordered it to do, that has the potential to reset this whole thing.
Which would then mean starting from scratch and having to be compliant for the next 3 years.
Yeah, that's my understanding. Yep, because they have to hit 3 years before they can be released from the consent decree.
So worst case scenario for the school district is
this year was a bad year and they have to prove the next 3 years of compliance with the consent decree. What's the worst that could happen from another 3 years of oversight?
You know, I think there's a lot of special education advocates and the Southern Poverty Law Center that would say that absolutely that's what should happen here. The right schools weren't monitored. That's a problem. And in fact, there are still schools that are under intensive corrective action plans. So separately from the wrong schools being monitored, the Southern Poverty Law Center thinks that these schools should still be monitored anyway. Now, on the reverse, I would say basically the worst, you know, the worst case scenario in quotes is that, you know, this is potentially going to cost the state and the school district a lot more money over the next 3 years in legal fees and in monitoring fees. But I think special education advocates any day would say that that would be well worth it.
Marta Jusen, thank you as always for your reporting.
Thank you.
Utility advisors for the New Orleans City Council issued a recommendation this week that Entergy New Orleans should attain, quote, net zero carbon emissions by the year 2050. Michael Isaac Stein reported the story for The Lens. Michael, what did the report say?
So the report was issued as part of the City Council's Renewable Portfolio Standard docket. So the City Council, as the regulator for Entergy New Orleans, maintains the right to dictate where our energy should come from. So Renewable Portfolio Standard is something that a lot of regulators have done around the country. And I know we've talked about this before, but mostly regulators are on the state or regional level, where we're in a pretty unique situation of being able to control this on a local level. So, you know, again, repeating that process that's been done by other regulators, and basically over the past, you know, 6 months or so, parties to the docket, which include Entergy, a number of consumer advocates, environmental organizations, have all submitted evidence to the council. You know, one coalition called the Energy Future New Orleans Coalition actually submitted their own complete plan. So basically, this is the advisors looking at all of that evidence and suggesting to the council what they think. And the big news coming out of this report, there's really two things. The first big thing is that they say that by the middle of the century, by 2050, New Orleans energy should be emitting zero carbon, or at least net zero carbon. And the other big thing is that, you know, Entergy had been saying that the renewable portfolio standard should be voluntary instead of mandatory. And they had argued that a requirement to create a certain number, a certain level of renewables, for example, just that they were saying it might just raise customer bills too high. But the advisors disagreed with that argument and said that any renewable portfolio standard, no matter what the council chooses, should be mandatory, which just means that Entergy, New Orleans, whatever the council decides, will have to do it. And the mid-century decarbonization goal is relevant. There was a pretty huge landmark report issued earlier this year by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, basically saying that if we want to avoid some of the most catastrophic effects of climate change, that the world has to be net zero carbon by the middle of the century, by 2050. So this is kind of following those guidelines.
Obviously, net zero is the, you know, the whole composite. How do you achieve net zero in this case?
Yeah, there's basically two main directions that you can go when trying to achieve net zero carbon emissions. The first way is kind of a little more simple, and it's what is preferred by the Energy Future New Orleans Coalition. And basically, it's all renewables. So all wind, all solar. You know, we don't exactly know what's going to exist in 2050, but all renewable energy sources, and which do not emit any carbon emissions. And so that's kind of just the simple way to do it. The second way to get to net zero carbon emissions kind of is an expanded toolbox, is how it's commonly explained. It includes renewables, but it also looks to other sources. So a big one is nuclear power. And you know, looking at New Orleans specifically right now, nuclear power is actually a huge part of how we've been able to keep our emissions rates down. It provides about 55% of New Orleans' energy needs and doesn't emit any carbon. There are other things within this wider net. One of them is carbon capture, which hasn't really been achieved on a you know, utility scale yet. But again, we're talking about, you know, 30 years down the line, so it's kind of a wait and see. So between those two directions, the advisors prefer the net zero goal, including other sources like nuclear and carbon capture. They say that will be the quickest way that we can get to zero carbon. They also say, however, that it's going to be a question of the council's priorities. So, you know, if you want to prioritize economic development in the renewables industry and getting more local jobs, then they say that the preferred route would be the renewables route, the route that the Energy Future New Orleans Coalition prefers. So they left those options open to the city council. So at this point, you know, they're going to choose between those. And like the advisor said, it just will come down to priorities, whether it's speed of decarbonization or, you know, pretty fast decarbonization with an emphasis on creating economic opportunity, making sure that, you know, low-income people can participate in the new economy and, you know, doing community solar projects and things like that.
And really slower, but a complete overhaul of our system.
Right. And I think a lot of people argue that when we're talking about this transformation of the energy system, as dire as you can see climate change as being right now, people will argue that equity is also important. You know, I think there are some carbon reduction tactics that have become almost like a luxury good. You know, you look at like electric cars like Tesla, you know, solar panels have become almost an indicator of wealth. So, you know, it's important to a lot of advocates that as you transition to a renewable net zero carbon emission economy and energy system, that you build it in the right way.
The right way being a way that is equitable and accessible to everybody.
That's right.
And on that note, what impact would this shift have on consumers?
Yeah, that was actually one of the more surprising parts of the report. They said that this could be achieved with only a 1% increase on the average customer bill. And the way they do this is by setting a cap on what Entergy could spend every year to achieve these goals. So it would be 1% of retail sales, which this year would come out to somewhere around $6.1 million. How exactly that would work is still a little unclear. For example, they say, you know, a project that Entergy would have done anyway without this mandate would not be included in the $6.1 million. But how they're going to determine that is unclear. You know, there's also some contingencies put in there. For example, if they're not meeting their goals, but they're also not spending the maximum allowed amount every year, they could be penalized for that as well. So there's some mechanisms there to make sure that Entergy continues chasing these goals.
So who is for this idea and who is against it right now?
I think, you know, a mandatory decarbonization effort is mainly opposed by Entergy. It will probably be expensive. And I think more than that, it's just not what they've been doing for years. It'll take a big shift. And, you know, it's a monopoly, and monopolies are often not pushing towards innovation as fast as, you know, a company in a competitive market. So Entergy has been able to make profits year over year doing the same thing for a long time, and this would really force them to completely reshuffle how they do business. Air Products and Chemicals is also against it. They're relevant because they're actually the biggest customer of Entergy New Orleans, and they are often parties to utility dockets. They do have a lot of say, and they kind of represent these bigger industrial users. I think they have some fears that either Entergy could become less reliable or that their bills will rise.
And as with most of our conversations about things going on at the city council, what are the next steps that we can expect in this process?
Right. So the council is going to take this report. Parties will also have until October 1st to comment on it and respond. But the council will take all of that and they will write up a resolution of their preferred model. And then they'll take that to a council vote. So there'll be probably a hearing in the utility committee meeting followed by a full vote at the city council. We don't know exactly when that's going to be, but it's safe to assume that it's not going to be until after the council votes on a final budget. That's due December 1st. So sometime in December, January is probably when we'll see it come up.
And ultimately, just to tie it all together, what they're deciding is whether this proposal should be mandatory and which direction they're heading in.
That's right. And you know, looking to what this means practically, looking at the most recent integrated resource plan, which basically looks at all of our energy resources, it basically says that up until 2033 or so, we won't need to add any new generation. We're pretty much good for right now. But what this is saying is starting then, when we start those deactivations, we're going to have to replace those with renewable sources or emissions-free resources. So there's a good amount of time to plan for this. And I'd say, you know, the most significant part of this is it's basically establishing that at this point forward, we're not going to be investing in generation that emits carbon emissions. So it's a pretty significant move.
Michael Isaacstein, thank you so much for sharing that information with us.
Thank you.
That's it for this week. Thanks for listening to Behind the Lens. I'm your host, Jessica Rosegard. We'll be back next Friday. And please consider supporting nonprofit journalism in New Orleans. Go to support.thelensnola.org to make a donation today.